This podcast is part of the Gonna Geek Network. The opinion expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gonna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GonnaGeek.com and get ready because geekiness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Whitten.
I prefer to jazzercise my demons, but yeah.
And my co-host, Haley Malley.
That line you're worrying about crossing. Look behind you.
And Keir Hansen.
Gallifrey Public Radio. Now we have maths.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But if we get into anything too serious, don't worry. We'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 94 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we suffer from a complete identity crisis along with the worst case of sunburn you've ever seen. Seriously, it's like we're glowing here. I'm your host, Haley Malley, and with me in the GPR studios this week are Jay Whitten.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going all right, and you?
I'm doing fantastic.
That's good. And Keir Hansen.
Magnificent day. Magnificent day.
Good to hear.
Yeah, so this week we got the new official trailer, and it's giving us more and more things to ponder as the August 23rd date approaches. And fans are still really divisive on the whole, am I going to like this guy question that all Whovians have faced at some point. We decided to take a look at the nature of Time Lord regeneration itself. Is there rhyme or reason to it? Do the writers, producers, and other creators of canon have any rules or parameters that they work within when shuffling the deck, so to speak? Or has the idea of a pattern been a practice that only applies when the individual at the controls at the moment are setting the stage for a character and plot arcs that they know that they're going to be in control of later?
Yeah, so did they really think this one out? Or is it something where they do the casting because they think they've got an opportunity to work with someone who could take the story in a great direction, but there wasn't really a reason why, you know, they said, all right, we want you to play your cards really close to the vest, but this time around, we want you to wear your heart on your sleeve and that sort of thing. You know, was there really according to the overall story, you know, from start to finish over these past 50 years, was there any pattern to it? Yeah.
Is it something that they actually thought out, or is it something that we have given life to as fans, which happens so often?
Yeah. I think you could really argue it either way. You know, the conspiracy theorists might say that, you know, oh, there's been a real lot of thought process to this all along. And other people can say, well, it's like numerology. You can apply a theory to it and make it stick just because you've made an intricate theory. But it doesn't mean it's actually basis in fact. It just fits nicely. You know, you're applying a story to a story. So,
yeah. So, I mean, we've got a lot to go on here. And I mean, there's plenty of times where obviously you see something that happens with one doctor lead into the next one. And you can tell, okay, that's something that has grown, something that has, you know, come out of this experience. And then there's other times where it's a little bit more subtle. It's a little bit less defined, but you can definitely, once someone explains it to you, it's like that spot on the TV that now that someone's pointed it out, you can never not see it. Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot, Jeff.
But well, that's kind of that numerology thing. You know, it's like the people say, oh, the number 21, it appears everywhere. And you wouldn't really think about it, but then someone points it out and now you're looking for it all the time. But we started, you know, discussing this a while ago, or at least saying, oh, okay, well, I can see where they led to, you know, if you're staying within two regenerations, you know, oh, from 10th to 11th, okay, I see the bridge, you know, oh, from 9th to 10th, I see that, oh, from 2nd to 3rd, I understand that one. But is there one that actually runs the full stretch? Well, maybe. We come across some interesting theories out there. Some more, crackpot than others. And some only work on shorter, like I said, you know, shorter curves, you know, second, third, fourth, or, you know, six, seven, eight, or something like that, you know, but it's tougher to see that across the entire span. Let's kind of walk through these here. Let's see what we're up against.
All right. So with the first doctor, you know, leading from William Hartnell into Patrick Troughton, the doctor lived to a ripe old age. He got old, and then there was a very trying experience with the Cybermen. You know, he just got overworked, strained, exhausted, and basically said, you know, he felt like he was stretched too thin.
Yeah. And he had been in that form for an extremely long time, you know, just to be in that form, which is something that within the story wouldn't kind of make sense. You know, if you've got a physical body that ages and deteriorates like any other, but you've got the ability now to do a little body hopping, so to speak, or swapping, then okay, that one, of course, you know.
Yeah.
That was a great model. Give me another.
All right. And then, so then we've got, Troughton to Pertwee, who, this one was forced. So this one was basically a, the Time Lord saying, nope, you're done in this form. We're moving you on to the next one. And I mean, they gave him choices and he kept refusing. He's like, no, not that one, not that one, not. Okay, fine. We'll pick for you then.
Mm. So. But it was just, the interesting thing here is that now the writers had more time to prepare for what they knew regeneration was actually going to be written, and they started defining standards for how regenerations were going to be done. Like right. They had kind of like a handbook going as to some of the nature of the way that regenerations were going to behave, because they were doing it for the first time around just now. It was something that up until that point with Hartnell they had never even planned for, and now they got a bit of a lead in time, and they could. And they could start to, you know, figure out the rules and regs, so to speak, that they were going to play by. They had a note in their own handbook in 66 that said, you know, the metaphysical change which takes place every 500 years or so is a horrifying experience. It's an experience in which he relives some of the most endurable moments of his long life, including the Galactic War, which was believed at this time to have been the cause of the Doctor and Susan's departure from their home planet. And they quote, it is as if he has had the LSD drug. The LSD drug. He's been having the LSD drug. And instead of experiencing the kicks, he has all the hell and dank horror which can be its effect. So... And they were actually referring to it up to that point as renewal and not regeneration when they were first starting to figure out how they were going to do this.
Right. So. This was still really early on. And then we, as things kind of progressed and made more sense, we got the third Doctor regenerating into the fourth one. And this one was, you know, irradiation. He basically got a lethal radiation dose and had to regenerate to save his life. You know, it was,
and these are the ones where you, because of the nature of it, because it wasn't one that was either natural causes, so to speak, or one that was under the strict control of the Time Lords, you know, pushing him through this, or I should say, you know, maybe even guiding him through it. He doesn't come through this one well, you know. It's he comes out of it really disoriented, you know, and he's healthy, but he's at a loss, you know. So it's there's something to be said too for how each production team or each era along the way chose to handle the after effects of the regenerations too.
Right. So, and I mean, this actually kind of begins the bad stuff happens and leads to his regeneration thing. Like the first couple, it was like, okay, old age, then we had one forced on him. And now it's like, this is his get out of jail free card pretty much every time. I mean, I can't think of anything beyond the 11th that was really a, you know, oh, it's time for me to get a new face now. I've run my course, or, you know, it was forced on him again or whatever. Everything else was something bad happened. This is my only option.
Well, the only other one that had any degree of control to it that I can think of is actually Eighth's handing over to the War Doctor.
Okay. You're right. Yeah, I didn't think about those.
Yeah.
Well, he was going to regenerate either way. He just kind of controlled what direction it went.
Well, no, he was going to die. He got the second chance. You know. Yeah, and then when the War Doctor regenerated into Eccleston, that was more of a, well, the job that I took this form for is done. I'm moving on now.
Right. I took this detour and now I'm meeting back up with the main road again.
Right. Yeah. So, but I mean, that leads us to the question though, is the stuff leading up to it, or is stuff that happens in his lifetime, so to speak, does it play into what comes after?
You know, meaning what he's learned from the last go around have anything to do with where he heads in the next form?
Yeah, basically.
Okay. Well, then back up a little bit.
Okay, yeah.
Back up when we went from first to second. Okay, so we go from the grandfather curmudgeon to...
Right, now, and to someone that didn't want anything to do with anyone. Someone who was very much like, I'm my own man, I'm going to do what I want, you're all inferior, and you serve no purpose but to get in my way. And throughout his run, he did gain more friends. He did gain more people that he could trust and rely on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that led him to the point when he... you know, when he became a new person, it's like, well, okay, friends are important. They can help me out. They're not just inferior beings that serve no purpose.
Well, theory being that if one of the things that was keeping him at arm's length through a lot of those early adventures was the fact that he was notably older in form and I'm not going to say frailty, but, you know, physical capability and that sort of thing, or just sort of keeps him generationally away from the individuals that are traveling with him or that he does come to befriend, then maybe the next time around it's, you know, it's advantageous to be a little closer to that age group, or just to have a personality that's going to be a little more affable.
Yeah. So but then, you know, going along with that, obviously he's going to get into more trouble. And we did see that with the second Doctor. He was, you know, he got into trouble all the time, and his motto was typically, you know, run. It's like, oh, things are getting serious. Let's go.
Or bung a rock at it.
Exactly. One of those two options.
Yeah. But then it comes right down to it. You look at his exit point where he's put on trial by the Time Lords for some of the violations of the primary laws of time. And his punishment is to be exiled on Earth because Earth happens to be, just like he is, a magnet for trouble. So they basically force the two of them together. And if that's the case, and he's going to be stuck there, and he knows he's going to be stuck there, he knows he's going to be without the ability to repair his TARDIS, so he's going to be at disadvantages in those regards as well, but he knows he's going to a location that just is primed to be invaded all the time, and he, you know, conjures trouble out of thin air just by being in the room, then he's going to have to be basically a Swiss Army knife of capabilities to get through the next foreseeable span of time.
Right. And I mean, that's exactly what we get with the third Doctor, is someone who is very well versed in science, who knows his thing, who knows how to, you know, think his way out of most anything. And then when situation does call for actual physical intervention, somebody that can handle it, you know, he can actually stand up and fight someone instead of, oh crap, run.
Right. Yeah. Well, there's where it starts getting a little different then, because if this was a punishment period, Third Doctor's time there was, you know, good relationships with his companions, good, really strong establishment of work with UNIT. You know, he's done his job. You know, he's been a good foot soldier. Now for the Time Lords, he's done his job protecting Earth. Now he's got the ability to do some traveling again. And immediately starts getting himself into life-threatening situations and so forth. But he's played by the rules. So when he's got an opportunity to shift out again, or I should say, not an opportunity, but when it comes time to have to shift out again because of the radiation exposure, where does he go in terms of, you know, what kind of influence does that have over who he becomes next? And you get the grinning madman.
You get the best regeneration ever. That's what you get.
So, well, carry it through, carry it forward.
Well, I mean, you think he spent a lot of time on Earth and really got to know the people there. And we see that carry over into the fourth Doctor who, you know, who still loves humans. They're still very close to his heart, but he did go a little stir crazy and he wants to get out. He wants to see different things. He doesn't want to sit in, you know, in the 1970s working for UNIT anymore. So we do see a lot more of the traveling and the going exotic places and things like that, but there's still that very, you know, set, I want to take humans. I want to be with humans. I want to help them out. Mm.
But he now has the opportunity to be able to not only work with humans again, but now he starts to get some other companions to accompany him as well, including another Gallifreyan.
Yes.
Which I think has a profound impact on him in terms of opening his eyes to the capabilities that he had been denied for that span of time. So, but there's a tough instance, because then you also had all of the headbutting with the Master. You know, it just became the Doctor and the Master show every couple of weeks, again and again and again and again. So now everything just becomes these instabilities. You know, companions are coming and going. You know, villains are coming and going. Now he's starting to travel more often and be in more locations and start to blip around the universe here. And nothing is staying constant for him. So when the Master chucks him off a radio tower, and this is where we first get a regeneration where you get the real haunting, which they used a few times. The whole idea of the, you know, the voices and the faces from his past swirling him around him, some trying to be voices of calm and reason, and others there to taunt him. He does not come through the regeneration well.
Yeah. No, and I mean, he does go a little bit nuts when he first regenerates into the fifth Doctor.
And physically incapable. I mean, he's in a wheelchair that the TARDIS has to provide for him. They got to put him in the zero room to try and help him
stabilize.
You know, yeah, ride the thing through. Basically, sensory deprivation. But talking about that personality shift, if everything was unstable for him towards the end of his fourth iteration, and he's seeking that stability, then you get the dad, you know.
Yeah.
It becomes a big family thing.
Yeah. And I mean, it really did, is that, you know, Davison really did, you know, anyone that came in was accepted. He wanted the friends. He wanted people to feel like they were welcome and they didn't need to go anywhere else. And, you know, anyone who ever like showed up, it's like, hey, look, there's pizza delivery guy. Hey, come in here inside my TARDIS. Hey, you're going to travel with me now. And that's really how it went.
Even if they were out to kill him, Turlo.
Yes.
Yeah, sure. Come on in. I'll change your mind. It's all right.
But he did, you know, and that's how it worked, is that, you know, we joke about it being the flying schoolroom, but it really was a sense of family with the fifth Doctor.
Correct. Yeah. Well, then here's where we want to start. This is where some of our familiarity and the pattern starts to get a little more complicated. Think through the way you would describe Davison's run. I mean, aside from the fact that, yeah, he's got a damn near an entire schoolhouse in the TARDIS at times, and he spends a lot of time getting in and out of his usual binds and treating his family or his group of kids, you know, Carl, stay in the house. Stay in the house, Carl. Carl never stays in the house. They get into 1,000 scrapes, one of them dies, another one just decides to tap out, that's it, I'm ghost, off and gone. He's got an android for a little while, the android, you know, commits, you know, seppuku and whatnot, so he's not, and all the while he's standing there going, listen to me, could some, just stay in the freaking house. So maybe if he had been a little firmer of hand, or had a little sterner dad personality to him, he might have been able to avoid some of the incidents that he did. So when we run into, you know, time for this regeneration as a result of the illness, you know, he gives the last of the antidote from the bat's milk to Perry. God, would you save her? in Caves of Androsani, and lets himself go. Again, another one of those haunting, the images and the faces swirling around him, haunting him for all the things that he tried to do that couldn't, and people come and gone. Maybe the next time around he needs to have a little bit firmer hand.
Yeah, but he kind of overshot it just a little bit.
Well, I think we've learned to appreciate Colin.
Okay, yes, but he was say like at 2 and he wanted to take it to 5 and he dialed it to 11.
Right. Overshoot it and you'll be fine. Yeah, at least you meet your goal. Okay. But as a result of the writing, we know in the backstory and things that the regeneration had to be kind of abrupt.
Right.
And they didn't really have the time to do sort of an episodic lead into it. So it was really one of those things where they had his replacement in the scene already face down, and they were going to write the instance around it. With this one, I think Colin got a bad run on his way out. He should have been able to have some sort of a nice send off line or two, rather than just having him, you know, smack his head in the side of the console because of a crash landing. And
well, that was because he quit. I mean, that's what it basically boiled down to, though.
Yeah,
that was Sylvester McCoy in a blonde curly wig doing all that stuff. Baker wouldn't even come back to do his regeneration scene. So yes, it sucks in hindsight, but I'm not going to give him this one.
No. And he's had his opportunity to redeem himself and play through his regrets in all of his involvement today. But so this was, in my estimation, an interesting regeneration, because unlike many of the predecessors, there didn't really seem to be a lot of ill effects coming out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he woke up and he was still facing Ronnie there in the control room, and basically picked up the conversation right where he left off. You know, and the scene continued as if it were something that were still going on. You know, he was not even aware of the fact that the change had really occurred. So it's just really interesting that that time around, because it was something really abrupt, a massive blow to the head kind of a thing, that his body and his sense of identity or his sense of his cognizance about himself and his situations didn't even pick the needle up off the record. It just strikes me as kind of interesting. I'd like to be able to play around with that more. But when we're taking this theory as to why we went from the Baker ego to the McCoy mad professor, what's the thought as to why these have, you know, why these actually dovetail?
Well, I mean, it leads to believe that, you know, you take someone with such a huge ego, and when they want to change, they're not going to be able to instantly, like, okay, well, I'm going to be friendly again. You know, it's, you have that kind of, I'm going to try and, you know, be less, brash, but that typically leads to more closed off. Mm. You know, you don't open up to people, you just stop spouting everything.
Right.
You know, and we did see that with the Seventh Doctor, that he was more reserved. He kept things close to the chest. He was very kind of mysterious and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was also a bit of a trickster, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, the one thing you can say about Six was he didn't hide anything.
Yeah.
I mean, he said exactly what he felt, shouted what he felt.
And sometimes it was absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. But I think I think his travels with Mel kind of wore down the corners a little bit. Because she was such a spitfire that, you know, the two of them kind of, with his time, you know, butting heads constantly with Perry, and then with Mel just steamrolling and, you know, here, you're going to work out, you're going to change your diet, you're going to do this, and the other thing, kind of softened him a little bit. So he was, I think if he had stayed longer, they might have actually changed or softened Sixth's persona a bit if he had had another season to it.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why they said that when they went into putting McCoy at the helm, they wanted someone who had the ability to take those strong points when necessary, but was really also tapping into a lot of the aspects of some of his predecessors to get a sort of a total package of likability. Because you can see a lot of the previous doctors in McCoy, in his wardrobe, in his behavior, in his age, you know, sort of right in the middle there, so to speak. And just sort of the way he behaved. You know, he at times was the professor, but he was also the father, but at times he was also the protector, or he was the benevolent god, and that sort of thing. So, but then regeneration gets rushed.
Well, you know, when you get shot and then somebody tries to do surgery on you to save you, and that winds up being what kills you, it kind of jacks up the process.
Seventh did, according to, you know, if you want to take the movie for what it was leading us to believe, as he's sitting there in the control, you know, he's sitting there in the TARDIS, he's sipping his tea, he's listening to his phonograph records, he's reading, what was he reading? The Time Machine? Issue was the Time Machine, I think?
I can't remember.
But he's had another good run. You know, his hair is silvered. It's kind of like the first Doctor, you know. Mm-hmm. He's been able to play it out and do things the way he wants to. So he's sort of come to an equilibrium in terms of his personality, and he's traveling alone at the time, you know, which is an interesting thing to note, that he's at that moment without a companion. You don't know how long that's been, but yeah, steps out into San Francisco and gets shot in the chest.
Welcome to America.
Thanks, Obama. But what does that do for where you go? You've got, you know, when we went from Hartnell to Troughton, it was a matter of, I want youth and vigor again. I want to live again. You know, I've seen things out and I've had all these experiences, and now I want to go back with the knowledge that I have. You know, it's that if I knew then what I know now, you know, or is youth wasted on the young kind of thing. Well, he's got the ability to take that back and be young again.
Mm-hmm.
So we end up with the long-haired poet.
Right. And I mean, that this one's kind of weird because, you know, at the beginning, we don't know who he's supposed to be. He doesn't know who he is. You know, it's the whole amnesia thing can really work for or against whatever theory you're going to throw at it. You know, you can play it either way. So this one's hard to really try and fit into the mold. But, you know, he does come out younger, much more, you know, energetic and personable. You know, he's not really as secretive anymore. I mean, he tells Grace everything, even the outright fabrication that his mom was a human.
Complete lies.
Absolute bollocks. But you know, he starts forming his team around him. You know, he's not just the one companion. He's like, no, I need more people. I need more of a support structure. I don't want to do this on my own anymore.
He does still have that adventure streak, the idea of going out and seeking the opportunities, not necessarily looking for trouble, which he had done before, but now it's that curiosity is reborn.
Right.
And maybe that's because McCoy and Seventh was the idea of going out on larks, but everything was always done because there was an agenda. It was like your dad planning your trips for you. You know, okay, you're going to get in the car, we're going to be here by this night, and we're going to stay overnight there in this crappy motel, and the next morning we're going to get up at 7 a.m., and we're going to go off and do these things. Whereas Eighth Doctor was, once he started getting his footing, or starting to get some sort of a grasp of who he was and where it all fits in, it was all about adventures now. Literally, adventures. And going out and enjoying it. So, which is why, if that's the case, if, as you're saying, Jay, he likes having a team with him, and he's off and taking him and his crackpot squad out there to do who knows what, but they're always done for either for curiosity or for, you know, philanthropic means or what have you. Mm-hmm. What happens when the call comes to return to your duties?
Well, I mean, we did see this in The Night of the Doctor. He ran. He took off. You know, he was not wanting to get involved. He didn't want anything to do with the Time War. And it was basically forced upon him. You know, he got to the point where, you know, he was dead and the Sisters of Karn basically said, no, look here, you can regenerate. Just, you got to drink this thing, whatever. And that's when he made the choice. He's like, okay, fine. If I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it right. I'm not going to half ass it. I'm going to be the warrior. Right. And that's what we see.
Yeah. This is something that can be done and I can be relied on to do it, but I can't do it in the name of the Doctor. So the Doctor has to be put aside for this next span of time.
Right.
So that, and because of the fact that we got this sort of out of sync, and this was sort of a retrofit on Moffat's part to try and stitch up some loose ends and give us some, you know, as he loves to do, he loves to solidify canon using some of the things that are still sort of either half liquefied or just squidgy, and you just, you know, these gray areas, and he loves being able to say, look, here, what do you think of this? And puts it out, and it just, you know, threads everything together nicely. And okay, I get that. And it gave us an opportunity to be able to really put some proper closure to McGann that we didn't have previously.
Now, all right, one thing I want to ask you guys is that there was a lot of talk about Eccleston coming back to be the war doctor, you know, to be the doctor that made the choice, whatever. And that could have worked, yes, but what if it had gone the other way? What if it had been the Eighth Doctor who, through everything that he went through, decided to get involved? And it was actually the Eighth Doctor who made that choice. I mean, can you, like, just play that little bit in your head? And, like, what does that strike you as?
If all you see before that is the movie, then have him drop into, you know, the War Doctor's role, that would have been jarring.
Okay, valid point. I guess, go ahead.
Well, no, I'm just thinking the Eighth, what we had known, or what we had been given about what Eighth represented for the timeline just didn't comply. You know, it just, he's not capable, which is exactly what I think they wanted to try and express, was that he was incapable of going to the lengths that he knew were going to be necessary to carry these things out, to enact the moment. And commit the, you know, the double genocide. You know, he obviously didn't have that kind of forethought at the time, but something of that scale would be necessary in order to take a war that had been going on for as long as it had, with as many casualties as it had, that had, you know, the people caught in the crossfire that hated both sides. And I don't think, as far as what impact that would have on Ninth when we finally get him, I mean, cause right now, as it stands, Ninth stands there like a war veteran come home, you know, PTSD.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, and granted, he's still got some youth and he still has some love of the good adventure, but you can tell, I mean, there's a tremendous amount of baggage being dragged along and these moments of where he's not quite there with you.
And I've got to say, I grew up in Hampton Roads in Virginia, which is a huge military section in Virginia, and most of the people I knew growing up were military or military kids or whatever the case was, and I've seen a lot of people come back from deployment and things like this. And I don't know if Eccleston researched or if he knew people like that, but he did a fantastic job of portraying that, you know, that I know my routine. I know what I'm supposed to do. I know the things that interest me, but there are times when I just don't get it. Mm. And it just, there's a complete disconnect as what am I supposed to do right now? There, I can't make sense of it. And it was a great portrayal because that's what we see is the war doctor, when he changed, he's like, I want to get back to being the doctor. I want to get back to being who I am and integrating back into my normal life. Mm-hmm. And we see Nine dealing with that. Like, how do I do that? And that's something that, you know, has a very real world, counterpart to it. And it matches perfectly.
Still capable of being a functional, amicable, contributing member of society, or in this case, you know, to the individuals that are around him. But there are points where there's a disconnect that he can't overcome or yeah. doesn't fully grasp in order to be able to deal with it on his own. Mm-hmm. So this, I think, gives us a really good foundation for when we do get to the parting of the ways and the idea of what he has to go through in the transition to 10th, everything that he's experienced over that past, well, we're going to say year with Rose, has given him this sense of therapy, I think, in a way, and has sort of guided him back to a point where he's on firmer ground. With himself, with his experiences, he has not by any means shed it all, as we obviously come to find out, you know, from what Tennant goes through, or Smith for that matter. But he's able to come to terms with some things that have been holding him back. And some of that was relationship wise, because he's got this, you know, this young 20 something pining or that has come to adore him, but there's no romantic relationship because, as she's even said, you know, he's a little old for me when she's trying
just a touch.
Well, she's trying to calm her mother down and say, you don't have to worry about any of this, Mom. I mean, look at him. He's, you know, he's got to be what, like 50? So, so if he's got any kind of influence over where he's headed in the next regeneration, why don't you narrow that gap a little bit? See what happens.
Yeah. And I mean, we do see that as he regenerates into someone younger, more age appropriate for Rose, and a lot more fun. And, you know, he jokes, he has fun. He's, you know, still has that very serious side to him if he needs to, you know, can still handle things if they go dark, but is much more concerned with seeing the beauty in the universe as opposed to the threats lurking behind every corner.
Right.
Now, Haley, now that we've kind of caught up to New Who, I mean, what are your thoughts on this? Do you see the pattern forming here? Do you kind of see how things are stitching together?
Yeah, I think when you get into New Who, you don't see as wild a swing in personality when you go from one doctor to the next. It's a little more gradual shift that kind of grows as they become the new doctor.
Yeah, okay.
Right. Well, yeah, because, I mean, there's three things that you're really kind of looking at with these regenerations. What impact does it have on them physically? And that seems to be more of what we're dealing with these days. They kind of play around with the whole physical aspect of it, you know, the I'm still cooking or what have you. There's the mental stability. And then there's the whole idea of, well, how much carryover is there in terms of what they're aware of or what they're in control of? You know, are they starting from a, you know, they're mentally stable, but they're confused because they don't really know what situation they're in? Or are they mentally unstable because their personalities are jumping all over the place and you're getting something that's, you know, oh, it's a mix of all these things. Like when we had, you know, in some of the previous doctors, you'd have ones where he was spouting lines from all of his predecessors because his brain was, you know, the synapses were firing all over the place. They seem to have put that aside, and now they kind of play around with the idea that, oh, new body, new hair, new nose, new ears. Ooh, yeah. Look, I can pull on them. So,
yeah, it's the personality carries over, and the physical traits are what you really have to adjust to. But with the 10th Doctor, you know, he has his time with Rose, has to cope with the loss of her. He gets Martha, who comes and decides, I can't deal with this, and leaves. He gets Donna, who still, worst way to exit a companion ever.
We're not discussing that right now.
It didn't happen.
Literally, for her.
Too soon.
But, we've got something very similar with the fourth Doctor in that he had companions and they were constantly coming and going and he couldn't keep anyone. And then at the very end, it was just this cascade of here's new people in my life and they're gone. Here's new people and they're gone. Here's new people. They're gone. And so it makes sense that when his time finally comes, one, he's going to say goodbye to everyone. He's going to go back and see the people that really matter to him and say his final goodbyes. And then realize that friends come and go, but family is there with you forever. And when we get to 11, he really latches onto that. When he first meets Amelia, most of his questions are about her family. Where are your mom and dad? Where's your aunt? What's going on here? He doesn't care about the extraneous stuff. He wants to know what's going on in this house right here, right now.
Mm-hmm. I think that's, again, you've youthened a little farther. You're dialing it back in terms of his physical age a little farther, if he has any sort of a say or an influence over that. If that whole idea of if there's that carryover that says the way to keep things close to me or the way to keep things near to me that I won't lose them again is to attach myself to them. Friends aren't enough. I need family. Well, he's done the paternal roles before on many instances. And if that hasn't worked out, maybe he has to go at it from a slightly different perspective and go at it from a sort of a sibling approach. So the way to do that is get even closer in age to the kind of companions that he typically partners himself up with so that they can become that sort of sibling dynamic.
Right. And I mean, so we get to the point where Amy and Rory become his family and we've talked about him as like the goofy uncle and stuff. And in this one, he's more like I almost want to say he's like the pothead brother who's come back from college.
That's exactly what I was about to say. He's just, your brother came back, your older brother came back from college. His hair's a little longer. He's got some tattoo he didn't have before.
And I mean, that's really how this is. It's like the older brother comes home. He's like, hey, jump in the car. We're going to go on a road trip. And
we're going to Tijuana.
You're gone all summer. And, you never know what situation you're going to wake up in next. And then we see as time goes on, they do become a family, literally, in the fact that, he marries River and they are a family unit. And then we come to Angels Take Manhattan and he loses them. So that leads to the question of what are we in store for now? Like he's run the gamut. Are we looking more at something akin to Colin Baker? Is he going to distance himself? We know that Capaldi has come out and said that he's 100% rebel Time Lord, but what kind of shape do we think that that's going to take?
That's an interesting parallel because Colin Baker was the rebel as well in every sense. It was a matter of, he was going to throw everything out there, damn anyone's opinion about it, from his physicality to his delivery to his presence was all a matter of, up yours.
Yeah.
So if you were to take that direction, you've got one very specific set of expectations or anticipations of what you think you're going to get from Capaldi.
But then we've also got the belief, and I mean a lot of stuff behind it, that it looks like he's going to take after the third Doctor. That's a lot of the photos are framed that way. That's kind of how he's patterned his look almost. And there's a lot of evidence showing that that's the way he wants to go too. So are we going to get an amalgam? Are things going to go off the rails? It's hard to tell right now what we're going to get.
Well, I think to a certain degree, if this theory kind of holds and it's a matter of most recent experiences serving to lay the path that the next iteration is going to walk, the previous experiences were a matter of gathering things close to him and still having them run through his fingers. You couldn't get much closer than to have your family around you. And if you lose your family, what does that leave you? Does that leave somebody who starts grasping for some kind of a faith? Or is it a matter of somebody who decides that they are going to have to break off and spend time on their own and research themselves? We also know that in the storyline right now, there's the possibility that he has to go back and find his planet of origin. So there's that home aspect.
Well, and we've gotten confirmation from a lot of the people behind the scenes that this is going to be a darker Doctor. This is going to be a much more serious look at it. It's not going to be the goofy fun of Matt Smith anymore. So that really does lead me to pattern my mind frame of this guy as more of a Sixth Doctor kind of, I'm going to get up in everybody's business and I'm going to make things happen and no one is going to stop me from doing what I feel needs to be done.
Okay. Yeah, I see that third, sixth blend, so to speak there. No, 63. There you go. That's about his age. I don't know. But then again, just bear in mind, we still have Clara in the mix.
Yeah.
She was definitely part of the whole sibling concept, which right. now can't apply. So what does that do as far as what he needs to be in order to hold that together? Or is it something that intentionally cannot be held together and we watch it deteriorate? Which makes for good television, but yeah. it's not going to do well for younger fans who have come to expect the Doctor to be, you know, your Tennant Smith, youthful, humorous, you know, high energy, low impact.
What do you think, Haley?
Well, you said, you know, he might be trying to distance himself after the loss he's experienced as Smith. And I can see him maybe trying to do that. And because he's got a carryover companion in Clara, her not letting him do that. And trying to hold on to the relationship that they had before.
Or find some way to adapt it against, well, obviously somebody who can't quite be the same person, but try and hold that together as near as she can.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense as to the kind of thing we're going to see in the first episode, possibly, that, you know, the Doctor's wanting to push everyone away, and we know that the Paternoster gang is going to be there. I can see Clara working with Vastra and Jenny, and, you know, making him take stock of what he does have and say, no, you can't push yourself away. We're not going to allow you to.
Right.
You know, we're going to follow you regardless of what you want.
And I wonder if we're going to see Clara win him over the way Victorian Clara won over Matt Smith's Doctor.
Well, she seems to be chemically created to undermine or to be able to get through the Doctor's defenses and liken herself to him with very little effort. So, and according to, you know, from what we're led to believe, has been able to do so all along. You know, be there as needed at the right time for all of his iterations, whether he was aware of it or not. So maybe that's just an inherent ability that she's going to be that guide or that anchor to see him through. But I guess the question is, who is it that she's seeing through? You know, I love playing around with episode names, you know, and if they're already, you know, if this is the one named episode, they give us a deep breath, right? That's what they're referring to this one. So when does someone tell you to take a deep breath? When you're panicking. You know, just calm down, have a seat, take a deep breath.
I was going to say right before they dunk your head in water. But, you know.
Or waterboarding, whichever. But that's kind of where my head goes with it, is the idea of, I mean, you see him in you know, from the first points of the console, you know how to fly this thing. He's wide-eyed, he's panicking. Right. So, you know, and what we're getting from the trailers about the things that he's asking her and the questions that he has burning in his head, you know, or the things that he needs to figure out, he's looking to her. Because he's unstable. So, I don't know.
So, are we going to see something like we saw with Eighth Doctor, where he just is completely unsure of who he is for a good stretch of the first episode?
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense.
That could be, you know, now that this is one of the first times where we're jumping up in age that we've done in quite some time. So, maybe they're going to use the idea of we don't want to spend too much time talking about the physicality here because we don't want to draw too much attention to the fact that we've just jumped 40 years in the guy's age. But so they're going to go with the mental and psychological stability route. So don't worry too much about the physicality because he did a snap to regeneration. I mean, he leaned back, glowed, bang, right back at the controls. You know, yeah. So it wasn't like he had to have a little sit down or anything like that.
He didn't have to take a nap.
Yeah, he didn't go running into any trees or anything. So
don't you hate it when you sneeze and turn into a Scotsman?
Yeah, I keep trying to make myself sneeze so that'll happen. So yeah, maybe that gives him the opportunity now. They'll say, all right, we're not going to focus on that. We're going to go over and we're going to play with him being lost in his own head and we need to rely on, you know, Paternosters and Clara to be there to walk through it. Maybe it takes part of an episode. Maybe it takes an episode and a half. I don't know. They've done it before. I mean, when they did it with Davison, he was spaced out damn near through the entire thing. So they carried it around in a coffin.
Here's hoping he remains conscious through the episode, at least.
It's not working out for Capaldi. Put him in this box, and we'll pretend that he's in there for about 40 minutes.
Oh, yeah. Well, thankfully, we only have about 7 more weeks to go.
Yeah, it's getting close. And now we're starting to get some really meaty stuff
coming out. Yes, we are.
Officially sanctioned stuff, not just the stuff that we've been, like, you know, turning over rocks to find spoilers and whatnot. This stuff is being handed to us.
Okay, yeah, but that one we're going to wait on. So you got to hold on to that one. Is this the one with Moffat in Series 9? Is that a new story, or is this...
No, that was the one that came out around the same time. It was all in one sort of bulk article, or we had seen it through most articles. They talked about the fact that Gomez was going to be on as a single character. They had the pictures of them all standing in the street with the fleet of Cybermen all standing behind them. And in that same article from Digital Spy, Moffat said, you know, oh, it's a great plan for this. And in fact, I've even thought my way through to the penultimate episode of Series 9, and it's going to just blow the doors off. You have no idea what's coming on this one. You thought I fooled you before. Boy, I'm gonna really mess with your head.
Yeah, so we've got the new Cybermen are going to be making another appearance in Series 8. So the brand new look that we got in the Game and Pend episode, and hopefully we see more of, like, the super speed or something, or, you know, maybe it'll just be the one-off, like, here, let me do this once, and now we're going to go back to the clunky walking.
Yeah, it wasn't even a proper upgrade. Didn't get a chance to spread it out to the other models.
Maybe that's what it was.
Didn't have time to upgrade?
Yeah. There was a problem in the network, and it just didn't upgrade.
Buffering. Damn it!
Oh, but yes, we do.
Who's streaming Netflix right now? I can't get a... Or it becomes that Haley moment. Hold on a second. Shut the up.
So but then we also have Frank Cottrell Boyce has been confirmed as one of the as the final writer for Series 8. So we now have all of the writers written noted. We know who they're all going to be now.
Have they assigned any of them to specific episodes?
Some of them, yes.
Yeah, only in certain cases. We can make sure that we include in the link dump. There's a few sites that have done a really nice job of sort of keeping the lay of the land up to the moment. So as writers get announced, they get thrown into the pot. As they get attached to certain episodes, that gets tacked in. So you can find them out there in a few places, but we'll give one to you as a convenience. Same thing for director slots and episode titles too, for whatever you want to take those to be worth.
Right. Oh, and then this bit of news that we've got, that apparently Peter Capaldi pushed to have his Doctor's style modeled after David Bowie.
Yeah, specifically the Thin White Duke era. He's been a big Bowie fan. He's gone to dozens of his shows and things, and, you know, generationally that kind of makes sense. But he apparently arrived in the early stages of his production work with a sketchbook. Of all the kinds of things that he would like to see influence or be incorporated into his look. And Bowie's Thin White Duke, the whole idea of everything from the styled coif down to the Doc Martens was all kind of part of that. Right. So and I get it, you know. Bowie has that very crisp, well manicured kind of look about him. He's a high maintenance kind of fellow and whatnot. But it's always it's power reserved. You know, he's a very dynamic performer, but when you look at him standing still, everything's in perfect form. And Capaldi, I think, maybe wanted to see some of that carried over into his appearance as well.
Yeah. And I mean, that's what Capaldi actually said too, was that he said he's woven the future from the cloth of the past. Simple, stark, and back to basics. No frills, no scarf, no messing, just 100% Rebel Time Lord.
If that's not t-shirt material right there, no scarf, no frills, 100% Rebel Time Lord, suck it.
USDA beef. So yes, but then the big news of the week is that we have a third official trailer for Season 8, or Series 8.
Like another 10 seconds of footage, guys. Crazy go nuts.
Yep, and it's all stuff that we're not going to see in the episode, too. It's great.
Yeah, a little CGI this time around.
Yeah.
And a voiceover.
But wait, it's a distinctive voiceover, though. We know this voice.
It's canine. Shh. Yeah. Damn it.
Yeah, but the voice that we hear the entire time sounds very much like a Dalek taunting him.
Yes, but not just any Dalek.
No. This heavily, heavily implies that we are going to be seeing the return of Davros for the first time since series 4.
So, and we were talking about this just before we had started recording tonight, that for those individuals who are really just kind of familiar with the New Who side of things, or the post-2005, sorry, I'm using the wrong terminology to keep people happy, and have only seen that little bit of Davros and what his backstory is, this has been a path that has crossed more times than we could probably count without having to do a lot of research again and dig it all up, because it's in the televised material, it's in the novelizations, it's in the newly added novels, it's in the audiobooks. They cross paths dozens of times. But we learn really interesting things about Davros specifically as well. So he's not just, you know, the mad creator. There's a lot more going on there that could allow us to have something really interesting if he's involved in Series 8 or what capacity. The fact that they choose to put him in there while we're still trying to figure out who the next Doctor is going to be is an interesting choice.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. But yeah, so next week we will be taking a look at some of the things that we've gotten with Davros and try and kind of catch everybody up, get everyone on the same page as we go into this, so that, you know, we can all kind of expect or see the same thing. But then the last bit of news we have, and here's the spoilers. So if you want to skip them, go ahead. We'll see you guys next week. Have fun. If you're still here. This is a bit of set photos that come, and it all takes place in Box Cemetery?
Yep.
And we have seen pictures of Clara's tombstones, both the brand new, Clara and Oswin Oswald, Victorian Clara, her tombstone, both pristine and aged. Mm-hmm. Ellie Oswald, Clara's mom. We've also seen Rory and Amy's tombstone from Angels Take Manhattan. And in a box filled with packing peanuts, there is
babies.
It looks like a cherub, and it's creepy. I wouldn't want to close the box.
Nope.
But this kind of leads to the theory, and also there's going to be there were Cybermen in the cemetery as well. So this leads to the theory that somehow these things are all going to be connected.
The fact that they're putting this all together in one shoot means that they're giving us all the makings for one of these massive scale finale showdowns where, you know, potentially, all right, so we've got Weeping Angels and Cybermen, which I think even in some of the other showdowns we've had, you know, the Big Baddie Collection showdowns, the Weeping Angels were kind of, they work on their own. But we've got the babies, really? Of all of them to bring out, the giggling babies? Oh, Christ.
You had to bring up the giggle.
God. Yeah.
I wanted to sleep at some point this week.
but yeah. So, and the fact that we're getting you mentioned the fact that tombstones are shown both in the pristine and the distressed versions, which means this is going to be things where they're probably doing it as a, for the sake of the production block and just shooting, scenes that are going to be chronologically, early. And then we come back to that moment, you know, however long later. Mm-hmm. But they've got the Williams or the Ponds stones there as well, which means that we're going to start tapping into past heartstrings. And if they're using this for the finale, that means they're going to be punching at 12, trying to hit him with material from 11. Uh-huh. All bets are off.
Yeah. So this is one of those things that's like, I want to dig. I want to find out more. I want to find out exactly what's going on. But at the same time, I don't really want to know anymore. I don't want to anticipate. I don't want to walk into it knowing.
Right.
It's rough.
So with news there about where we're heading into the finale for Series 8, even though we haven't even started it yet, right around the time we were releasing our episode previously last week, we had concurrently gotten the news, some bits of news about the fact Now, they're always trying to pick Moffat's brain about what little bits of information every time he speaks, if they're going to give him another little, or he's going to give a little nugget of information along. This time around, he decided he was going to completely confuse people about what he had planned going on for the next season and saying, well, you know, I've got big things in the works. In fact, I've already figured out the second to last episode for series 9. And in typical Moffat fashion, oh, it's going to be a real, you have no idea what's coming. You thought you knew Doctor Who before. And of course, in his usual line, this all came around the same time. You know, people were trying to ask him questions about the fact that Cybermen had been spotted in some of the production shoots where Michelle Gomez was going to be guest starring. And he decided to up the ante and not only confirm those sightings, but jump way ahead of things and sort of give the impression that he plans on at least being at the helm through series 9 as showrunner.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, that's the thing, is everyone's kind of jumping all over this and saying that he's leaving and stuff. No, basically what he's saying is he's going to be here at least until then. He's not announced that he's leaving. There's nothing like that. It's just all the headlines say Moffat stay through season 9. Like, it leads you to believe that he's leaving, but that's not the case.
Right. Yeah.
At least not yet.
Yeah, he's not starting to head towards the door or anything. In fact, he wouldn't even really address it in that regard. So he's just saying, you know, don't set me up for leaving just yet. I haven't even told you about half the crap that I'm still writing. So,
although I still say it's not too early to start those petitions to get Nick Briggs in as the next showrunner.
Yep, we're gonna put together that Kickstarter campaign.
Yeah, now, internet petition. We're not even gonna put money behind it. Just, you know, sign the petition. Because that works so well.
Yeah, like that petition to create the Paternoster Gang spinoff that's still circulating.
And put Nathan Fillion as Green Lantern in it.
I'm telling you, it works.
Yeah, but I don't know, it's getting close, and I'm really starting to get excited now. A couple things, just a couple notes that I've been meaning to bring up but haven't. If you guys want somewhere to discuss this kind of thing, the Gunna Geek forums have been put up and running. They now have the Tapatalk app, which you can put on phones and tablets and stuff to access it easier. Just go over to GunnaGeek.com, get on there. The forum link is on the top, and it's really starting to pick up there. So that's a great place to go and actually have some of these long discussions and stuff that Twitter can't really handle. So, and then I don't know if any of you guys have been watching the Musketeers on BBC America. I got into it, and it's actually a lot of fun seeing Capaldi play in those kind of roles, or in that role that he's got on there. It's small so far, like it's just a couple minutes every episode, but it's really a lot of fun.
Yeah, I've been hearing a lot of really great things about it. It's going to get on the roster there as part of the summer viewing, but it's behind Horatio Hornblower right now, so it's going to have to wait a little bit.
Yeah, I really just turned it on. I'm like, I just want to see how Capaldi does in this, and I want to, you know, kind of extrapolate from there what I could expect in August, and then I went and got hooked. So, yay, another show to add to the list.
At least it's summer. Yeah. You know, the crowd's a little thinner.
Yeah. Oh, yes. But
And if anybody has had the opportunity yet, obviously make sure if you want to see small snippets of Mr. Eccleston, he is currently appearing in very small quantities, but hopefully his role will be increasing on The Leftovers. Got to see him for all of about 90 seconds in the first episode, but does a fair upstate New York accent. I'll give him credit. He's done his speech, his voice acting work.
There was something one of my friends was complaining about the other day, or not complaining, but talking about David Tennant doing something and having an American accent. And
oh, the Americanization of Broadchurch.
Oh, is that what it is?
Yeah, no, okay. It's not working. It's not Tennant's fault. It's just one of those things where they haven't changed enough of the show. It's like what they did with Coupling.
Okay.
You know, when you take something that was inherently just sort of British in its delivery and its writing and its tone, and you just strip the accents out of it and drop it in New York or something like that, it just doesn't work.
Right. No, I mean, that's what they were saying, though, is that, you know, Tennant's accent was spot on. They're like, I can't pick anything that doesn't fit. Like, he does a great accent, but it's just because we know him so well and we've watched so much. It's just wrong hearing him like that. It's like, I look at him and I'm like, there's something wrong with it, but I can't pick out the one thing that it... I want to see it just to see what how it is.
I think he's going to snap in the middle of a scene and say, ooh, you timidest beastie.
Oh, yes. But anyway, this has been episode 94 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, I don't want to go.
He had to use it. This is Kier saying, I'd like to see a butterfly fit into a chrysalis case after it's spread its wings.
And this is Haley saying, see, that's the thing. I'm the doctor. But beyond that, I just don't know. I literally do not know who I am. It's all untested. Am I funny? Am I sarcastic? Sexy? Right old misery? Life and soul? Right-handed? Left-handed? A gambler? A fighter? A coward? A traitor? A liar? A nervous wreck? I mean, judging by the evidence, I'm certainly got a god.
We'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. Tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows by calling 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1477 to leave us a voicemail. You can head to GallifreyPublicRadio.com to leave comments on each episode. There you can also keep up to date on all the latest news and gossip, as well as what's going on in the community. Also, make sure to head over to GunnaGeek.com to find out lots of other high-quality, geek-centric shows. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2014.